Welcome to the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast. This is a podcast in which we explore the museum's collections development policy, speaking with guests from across the globe to delve into the language used and consider what really matters in this policy.
The Matters of Policy podcast series is an initiative of Marenka Thompson-Odlum, who is the researcher for the Labelling Matters project at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. The Pitt Rivers is an ethnographic and anthropological museum that collects, conserves, and displays material culture from peoples across the globe throughout human history. Acknowledging that the Pitt Rivers Museum was founded within a colonial framework, the Labelling Matters project seeks to reveal and redress its problematic past and the legacies that continue to inform the present. The Labelling Matters project looks into the power of language and reviews the ways in which language is used in relation to the collections housed at the Pitt Rivers Museum. The project touches upon many different aspects of language, including textual elements such as object labels, microsites, and policy documents, as well as visual features pertaining to the museum's displays. This podcast series zooms into one such aspect of language. Here, we review the language used within the museum's Collection Development Policy, or CDP in short. This document sets the legal and ethical standards for collection handling and serves as guideline for processes such as acquisition and disposal of objects. Additionally, it touches upon topics such as future collecting, repatriation, and treatment of human remains. The CDP is reviewed at least once every 5 years. The current CDP was approved by the museum's governing body in 2016 and is now due for review. In light of the museum's commitment to a process of redress and social healing, this project explores areas of improvement within the document. Interviews are conducted by Alexis Forer, Megan Mann, Bessie Woodhouse, and myself, Yip Borm, under the supervision of Marenka Thompson-Odlum. We are interning on the Labelling Matters project, as part of which we've looked into the museum's collection development policy. We've invited guests to talk about issues within the document in order to get a better understanding of what improvements can be made. We speak with a wide range of people working in or with the museum to get insights relating to questions such as: does policy match practice? Who is represented within the document? And what role can collection development play in the future? These conversations include artists who have commissioned works for the museum, external parties involved with collection development, and we speak with staff members working for the Pitt Rivers and other museums in the field. These conversations will be used to guide the writing process of a renewed collection development policy that is representative of the museum's work and mission for the following years.
Hi, I'm Bessie Woodhouse, and I'm in the process of completing my MSc in Museum Studies at the University of Glasgow. Throughout my postgraduate research, I focused on the link between possibility and policy within cultural heritage organisations, particularly examining how decolonial theory is reflected in daily museum practice. This has culminated in my dissertation research, which analyses policies and aims to create a framework for organisations to approach their historical legacies, specifically looking at public monuments here in Scotland. So my research has led me to my internship as part of the Labelling Matters project here. And yeah, I'm really excited to get going and start analysing this policy.
Hi, I'm Yip Borm. I live and study in the Netherlands, and I've worked as an intern on the Labelling Matters project of the Pitt Rivers Museum since October 2020. As part of this internship, I've helped analyse the language of a selection of labels on display in the museum, looked into the use of language on the museum's microsites, and written blog posts concerning the findings of this analysis. I'm also a master's student in global and comparative philosophy at Leiden University, where I'm currently researching the epistemic value of silence in imperialist history. In the future, I hope to work with Western institutions on existential and self-reflexive questions regarding the colonial legacies on which these institutions are built.
Hi, I'm Alexis. I'm an undergraduate student at the University of Oxford, reading archaeology and anthropology. I began working as an intern with the Pitt Rivers Museum this year as part of my dissertation research under my dissertation supervisor, Marenka Thompson-Odlum. My research focuses on the internal workings of Western museums like the Pitt Rivers Museum in advancing decolonial measures, especially in regards to tensions between museums and university or government regulations, and museums and stakeholder communities. As part of my internship and dissertation research, I'm following the new Collecting Award and Policy podcast series projects undertaken by the Pitt Rivers as part of larger decolonial efforts involving both practice and policy. So if you find this podcast interesting, stay tuned for my dissertation.
And I'm Megan Mann. I'm currently completing my master's degree in museum studies at the University of Toronto. I have a huge interest in decolonial theory and in particular repatriation, as well as medievalism and in the ways that the medieval world is represented in museums. Of course, I'm not going to do that for this podcast. So what I'm mainly wanting to focus on is the ways that we can decolonize how we present information in museums, which led me to Marenka, which led me to analyzing this policy, which I'm really excited to do on the rest of this podcast.
Great. So now that's introductions out of the way. We're going to look through some of the passages in order to familiarize ourselves before we start having our interviews in the subsequent episodes. Before each of our interviews, the guests were given specific passages to look at, as well as the CDP or Collections Development Policy as a whole, to provide some unique insight into the policy and how it could be changed or altered or interpreted differently depending on what their background and research interests were. In order for you, the listeners, to gain a little bit more insight into the policy, we're just going to discuss specific passages that we found important in our research. A lot of this has come off the back of a workshop that we did do with the Pitt Rivers Museum staff, which looked at a lot of these passages and discussed them wider, which we'll kind of talk about a little bit at the end of this introductory episode. First of all, we're going to look at the mission statement. It's important to note that the mission statement is not the current mission statement that is available as part of the museum's strategic plan that was updated. This one is from 2015 and is reflected in the collection development policy. But as the policy is a public document, it's difficult to kind of differentiate between this being online and being accessible and there not being a kind of caveat involved that it doesn't reflect the museum's current statement. So we'll look at it, but we'll look at it maybe with a pinch of salt. First of all, we'll just have a brief reading of the mission statement itself.
1.1. The Museum Statement of Purpose Mission Statement. The Pitt Rivers Museum aspires to be the best university museum of anthropology and archaeology in the world, using its unique galleries as the focus for exemplary teaching and research, and as an inspirational forum for the sharing of cultural knowledge amongst the widest possible public. According to the University of Oxford statute, the purpose of the Pitt Rivers Museum is to assemble, preserve, and exhibit the Pitt Rivers collection, and to promote the public understanding of anthropology and world archaeology and their teaching and research based on the museum's collections. The purpose of this policy is to ensure that the museum accepts and disposes of material according to a recognized strategy that is in compliance with national standards and to act as a guide for curatorial decision-making. In doing so, it will encourage public confidence in the museum as a suitable repository for collections and their future stewardship.
So I think best to hand over to Megan, who was looking a little bit more in detail about the mission statement.
Great. Thanks so much, Bessie. So the first thing we really wanted to zero in on is this definition of best university museum. While it is important to recognize that this mission statement isn't in fact the museum's current one, it's equally important to note that this is a public document, which means that anybody who was looking up the collections development policy would see this mission statement as the museum's guiding light. And since we don't believe that this really reflects the Pitt Rivers' true intentions anymore, it's just as important to change this one as it is to remember that they have already shifted their mission statement in other documents. So the word best, when it comes to any sort of academic or museum purpose, is at the same time as it is heavily loaded, it doesn't really say that much about what the museum actually wants to do. We all know that there is, among museums, of course, there's an edge of heavy competition. But the word best for this doesn't seem to actually reflect what the Pitt Rivers is trying to do with their new direction, which is decolonize and share multiple stories from different cultures and make sure that the museum is a safe place for everybody in light of a very deep colonial past. So when we say the word best, I think it's important to define what we mean by that. Is it the most forward-thinking? Is it the most academic? Is it the most inclusive? It's important to define these things. Another thing that we wanted to explore today was the definition of the word public. So this word shows up 9 times in this document and a lot in the mission statement without any clear definition or indication as to what the word public actually means. All it says is the sharing of knowledge amongst the widest possible public. And of course, I think that's quite common amongst museum policies, particularly in institutions like the Pitt Rivers, where the range of collections is so vast. However, I do think it is important to expand on this definition of public. What the rest of the interns and I are really getting at with this is, who is this museum for? What is its purpose? And how is that purpose reflected, or not reflected, in this policy? I'm sure that everybody agrees, I'm sure that the staff of the Pitt Rivers would agree, that museums should be for everyone. I'm sure that's what this line in the mission statement means. However, if it's not explicitly stated that the museum is also intended to be a space of healing and partnership for those whose artifacts the museum has in its possession, then the tone of the collections development policy will imply otherwise, especially since it is a museum that is deeply rooted in colonialism. As we know, this really isn't congruent with the Pitt River's actions and intentions, as their new mission statement is all about exploring ways to decolonize and create new partnerships with communities all around the world. However, if we don't define what public we actually mean, then this Pitt River's Collections Development Policy Statement will imply that it means a British public, an Oxfordian public, a public that is interested in seeing and preserving these works, but is not necessarily interested in creating partnerships with those who actually made them.
Great. Thank you, Megan, for that discussion about the first part of the mission statement.
The idea of the public is something that we all reflect on, and not just in the museum world, but in, you know, wider society, and what the public really means in terms of accessibility and, you know, moving things into an institution where one public is represented and another might not be, is something that needs to be at the heart of an institution like the Pitt Rivers, that need to recognise that. Next, we're over to Yip, who's going to discuss a little bit more about the second half.
Thanks, Bessie. So moving on to the final paragraph of the old mission statement, which to recap states that policy ensures that the museum accepts and disposes of material according to recognised strategy in line with national standards. Well, even if this is no longer mentioned as part of the new vision, this still seems a reality to which the museum has to abide, and thus it's important to bring this up nonetheless. Because the problem is that there is now lots of disagreement on a regional, but also a national and even an international level, on what's important and proper when we talk about acquisition and disposal. So it will be interesting to find out what room there is for museums like the Pitt Rivers to get involved in setting the national standards that it essentially has to follow.
Great, thanks, Yip. Now we're going to move on to some more specific aspects of the collections development policy. First of all, we're going to look in section 3, which is an overview of the current collections. First, we'll look at 3.1, which is the size, coverage, and significance of the current collections.
The museum's collections comprise artifacts from all parts of the world, from prehistoric times to the present day, along with major manuscript, photograph, sound, and film collections. In 2015, the collections numbered over 550,000 artifacts, including objects, photographs, and sound recordings, and 81 collections of manuscripts. All collections are designated as of national or international significance, reflecting the fact that the museum has one of the most significant archaeological and ethnographic collections in the world. Collections are used for research and teaching in the University of Oxford, and by scholars and students nationally and internationally, as well as in the museum's award-winning program of public outreach and educational activities. The museum is committed to making its collections accessible to the widest possible audience, as detailed in the museum's access policy. Displays are open to the general public daily. The collections are managed, documented, and displayed according to the museum's documentation policy and procedural manual, collections care and conservation policy, and access policy. Backlogs in documentation are being addressed according to the museum's documentation backlog plan.
Great. So I'm just going to pass over to Yip, who has been looking a little bit more in depth about 3.1.
Thanks, Bessie. Section 3.1 enumerates the number of objects, photographs, and manuscripts that make up the collection of the museum. And what caught our attention is that it is this information regarding quantity, which is then linked to the idea that the museum holds one of the most significant collections in the world.
And one thing to be discussed here is this relationship between quantity and quality. For it seems that quantity of collections is only ever meaningful if its quality can be ensured. So what has come up in some of the recent conversations around care for objects, and I'm thinking there of the many of the Pitt Rivers Museum webinars organized during lockdown, for instance. So one thing that came up is that a qualitative collection needs to tick many boxes, basically. It should, for instance, ensure a balance between preservational care and cultural care for objects. It should also fairly represent the different modes of being, knowing, and understanding linked to these objects. And on top of that, it should be easily accessible to visitors as well as stakeholder communities. So I guess in this series of interviews, we'll be very interested in hearing from our guests what they see as markers of a qualitative collection. And we want to try and discover what the challenges are in safeguarding a qualitative collection. And I hope that will give us a clear idea of that which is still missing and what can be improved within the current CDP.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. And just moving on to a different part of section three, which looks a little bit more at the ethnographic collections, and also part of section four, which looks at complementary contemporary artifacts. So Megan will discuss these a little bit further, but first let's just read out 3.2.1, ethnographic collections on page 5, and 4.2.1, complementary contemporary artifacts on page 7.
3.2.1, ethnographic collections. Selective highlights of the ethnographic collections include the Forrester collection of Pacific artifacts from Captain Cook's second voyage, 1772 to 1775. One of the great collections of 18th century Pacific art and material culture. Rich collections from Central Australia donated by pioneer ethnographs W.B. Spencer and F.J. Gillen. Great depth of 19th and 20th century collections from South Sudan, including those of eminent anthropologist Sir Edward Evans Pritchard. The Hopkins collection, made by the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company in 1841 to 1842, containing rare examples of painted and quilled Northern Plains war shirts, which have become benchmark references for scholars. European music collections, including a virginal by Marco Jadra, dated 1552, the oldest keyboard instrument in Oxford, as well as musical boxes and mechanical musical instruments. The collection made in 1825 to 1828 by F.W. Beechey and E. Belcher, officers on the sloop HMS Blossom, among the earliest Inuit collections in the world. The contents of the private museum of the Second Raj of Sarawak, donated to the museum in 1923. Exceptional Naga holdings, more than 6,000 objects, many collected by J.H. Hutton and J.P. Mills between 1915 and 1945, and constituting one of the best documented collections in the world. The collection of European firearms, General Pitt Rivers' original interest, which includes many early and type examples of great significance to firearms specialists. 4.2.1. Complementary and contemporary artifacts. The museum continues to acquire contemporary artifacts through anthropological fieldwork and collaborative research with source communities when relevant opportunities arise. The aim is to build on existing historic collections by adding contemporary artifacts that provide insights into current practice as well as different perspectives on early collections. Recent examples of this are the purchase of Naga textiles through an anthropologist working in Nagaland and a collection of quill work made by a Blackfoot artist.
Over to you, Megan.
Wonderful. Thanks, Bessie. The section 3.2.1 on ethnographic collections names 14 different colonial administrators who collected the museum's holdings. At the same time, only 4 cultural groups are mentioned, and no specific artist or creator is actually mentioned by name, which is a little bit silly considering that the Pitt Rivers has long-standing relationships with a lot of these groups, like the Naga and the Blackfoot, and have created multiple cultural workshops to deepen their relationships with these communities. So even though the ubiquitous public is not specifically designated, the language and focus of the collections development policy make it clear that this museum is intended to benefit a public that is white, British, and proud of their colonial history, which is obviously never specifically said, but it can be pretty well inferred from the language of the document, which is very much focused towards the colonial collections and not so much the people who actually made them and then the relationships that the Pitt Rivers has since struck up with these people. And as we all know that it isn't actually the Pitt Rivers' true mission, the other interns and I think it would be great to formally define the public as not only visitors, but those whose belongings the museum holds, and in fact, everyone who's been affected by the Pitt River's possession of these artifacts, which is in fact a lot of people, as the Pitt River's collections are so vast, there is absolutely no way that they can get away in this policy with mentioning only colonial administrators and not those whose artifacts the museum hold. Each of the different colonial administrators are named and called distinguished, but it's a little bit silly that original creators, not a little bit silly, it's disgraceful that the original creators aren't actually named when the Pitt Rivers has expended such effort in recent years in cultivating relationships with these groups to better their relationships with the people who made the artifacts that they hold in their museum.
Great. Thanks, Megan. I mean, of course, a lot of the time when it comes to historical objects, you know, we might not have the records, but there needs to be, as Megan said, some acknowledgement of equal footing between those who created and those who collected. Next, we've got a little bit more from point four and a little bit more from point three. So first, we'll look at 3.3, which is material not accepted for permanent collection, the handling collection. And then we'll look at 4.1, which is general collecting principles. And Alexis will look at both of these and discuss how they interact.
3.3, material not accepted for permanent collection, handling collection. The museum may occasionally, and with the written agreement of the donor or person transferring the material, acquire items that are not intended to be retained for the permanent collection. These items may be used as part of the educational or school handling activities to supplement student teaching or for destructive research. These acquisitions will be recorded separately outside the main accession record of the museum and shall not be treated as part of the permanent collection, since their intended use implies that preservation cannot be guaranteed. A record will be kept of how and when any material is disposed of. 4.1. General Collecting Principles. The museum will, in principle and subject to the qualifications set out below, acquire any material which falls within its areas of interest and merits preservation. Material will be acquired primarily for its ethnographic, archaeological or historical importance. Real duplication in acquisition is avoided, but material that shows the extension over time or space of a technique or a style is acquired. A favoured method of acquisition is to finance collecting or photographing in the field by graduate students or others doing ethnographic and archaeological fieldwork. This is economical and the resulting collections are thoroughly and expertly documented. Material is also accepted by donation, bequest, or purchased at auction or from dealers and private sources as funds allow. With the exception of short-term loans for temporary exhibitions, the museum does not normally now acquire specimens on loan. In exceptional circumstances, such as where it is legally impossible for title to be transferred from the present owner of a specimen to the museum and taking into account the safeguards under Section 1 and Section 9, a loan may be accepted for a specified period, if that specimen is of particular relevance to the museum's collection. The main constraints relating to collections development are the lack of space for storage, which also suffers from being dispersed at a number of off-site locations, and the availability of staff to carry out both cataloguing and deaccessioning procedures. A joint University of Oxford Museum's off-site facility for collections is in the early stages of planning. This, we hope, will provide high-quality storage for the museum's reserve collections, as well as facilities for research staff and visitors. The museum is continually seeking external funding to expand the scope of its stewardship work, also providing opportunities for volunteers to assist with such work as specified in its volunteering policy. Volunteers are engaged and managed through the Oxford University Museum's volunteer service.
Great. We'll just pass over to Alexis, who will talk a little bit more about these two sections.
Great. So these two passages for me, I think, really express this prioritization of preservation that is so prevalent throughout the rest of the CDP. In 3.3, for example, if preservation cannot be guaranteed, then the object cannot be considered part of the permanent collection. Preservation in this instance is a necessary condition for an object at the Pitt Rivers. Phrases like in 4.1, material which merit preservation not only reveal this underlying Western notion that preservation is the goal, but also reads as though the museum is the sole arbitrator of what merits, what is worthy of this treatment. I want to clarify, it's not, of course, that the preservation of objects is inherently wrong, if, and this is the key, if that is in line with the object's respective culture's conceptualizations of objects and agency and preservation. Instead, it's that the wording of the policy does not seem to allow for other avenues of treating and caring for collections, and thus for other views of the world and of material objects. Ultimately, preservation is not always a necessary condition for cultural care, and the CDP should reflect this.
Thank you, Alexis. I think this idea of preservation really comes up a lot in both the workshop that we did with museum staff and also in some of the later discussions that we have with our interviewees. It's very interesting. And yeah, we hope to kind of stimulate some really good discussion on that. Finally, we have another maybe very contentious issue, which is the repatriation and restitution of objects and human remains in the policy document. So Yip will discuss a little bit more on this. We're looking at point 15. So this includes 15.1 and 15.2 under the heading repatriation and restitution of objects and human remains.
And the restitution of objects 12. And human remains. 15.1. The Council of the University of Oxford, acting on the advice of the museum's professional staff and its governing body, may take a decision to return human remains unless covered by the Guidance for the Care of Human Remains in Museums, issued by DCMS in 2005, objects or specimens to a country or people of origin. Council will take such decisions on a case-by-case basis, within its legal position and taking into account all ethical implications and available guidance. This means that the procedures described in 16.1 to 16.5 will be followed, but the remaining procedures are not appropriate. 15.2. The disposal of human remains from museums in England, Northern Ireland, and Wales will follow the procedures in the Guidance for the Care of Human Remains in Museums and adhere to the Policy on Human Remains held by the University of Oxford's Museums, 2006.
Over to you, Yip.
Thanks, Bessie. So the current repatriation section, the first thing one notices is that it's extremely sparse. And this is partly because the museum pleads for a case-to-case approach, which we think is necessary since each request is different and brings together different histories, contextual circumstances, and also desires. But nevertheless, it could be more specific as to provide more information on barriers and solutions to challenges that come about during the process. One such challenge is, for instance, that repatriation is quite often, the costs for repatriation are often covered by the indigenous nation to whom the artifacts is being returned. This is something we as interns have been discussing. And in addition, we thought the repatriation section could specify on what responsibilities the museum sets to commit to. So we want to ask our guests, especially from other museums, what they added in their repatriation section and what they would like to see in the Pitt Rivers repatriation section.
Great. Thanks so much, Yip. And that concludes our deep dive into the collections development policy. Hopefully, this will have provided you all with a really good foundation and insight into some of the work that we've been doing so that we can kind of take this forward looking at these passages with the interviews that we're doing in future episodes with our interviewees. As we kind of mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this discussion of the policy and the passages that we've just done has come from a workshop that we did with Pitt Rivers staff earlier on in the summer. One of the things that really came across in that discussion, in the kind of open table discussion that we did following our presentation of the research that we've looked into in the passages, was this idea around accreditation. The reason that we are looking at the collections development policy is because the policy and the museum are up for reaccreditation. This is something that happens every 5 years. And basically, you have a collection of different policies that you send off to the Arts Council and the museum will receive accreditation. This basically makes sure that museums are aligned in ensuring that the collections that they look after are looked after in similar ways, adhering to local, international guidelines, and it does affect the funding that the museum receives as well. The collection development policy is a really core part of this, and because of this, it does need to tick a number of boxes which are provided by the Arts Council in order for it to be reaccredited. This is something that we really would like to look at a little bit further in our interviews, a little bit further in our own research away from this podcast. And hopefully this will stimulate a little bit of discussion around the accreditation process and thinking about whether accreditation needs to change and the guidelines for accreditation need to change as well as the policies, because if the policy has to adhere to accreditation, but the process of accreditation is maybe less flexible and less up to date than it could be, and that museum theory has kind of moved on, that maybe that needs to be something that's looked at, and this, you know, we'll discuss a little bit more in future episodes.
Great. Thank you guys so much. In this episode, we've given you listeners a good background on the biases of the current CDP. In the following episodes, we go in depth, bringing perspectives from Indigenous knowledge holders, artists, museum professionals, curators, and directors from other museums, and accreditation professionals. Finally, a special thanks to the Knowledge Exchange Fund for their support in making this podcast possible.
That was the Pitt Rivers Museum's Matters of Policy podcast, produced by Bessie Woodhouse, Yip Borm, Megan Mann, Alexis Boria, and Bobblehat Sound. Music by Jack Fawcett. Voiceover by Dougal Lott. A special thank you to Marenka Thompson-Odlam and the Knowledge Exchange.